Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now.
And now, please join us and all New Yorkers in a moment of silence.
Across the country, the second anniversary of 9/11 is observed. We'll have a report from Ground Zero.
And we'll check in with Gander, Newfoundland, sanctuary for thousands of travelers 2 years ago.
After they left, it was like we had lost a family. But we still, today, there's still people coming back, and they've developed relationships that will last for a lifetime.
Also, a world-class cellist marks this day in history.
And the president asks for broader power in the hunt for Al-Qaeda.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
These stories and more, coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Sounds of sorrow in New York this morning as the city remembered the day 2 years ago when terrorist-flown planes crumbled the twin towers of the World Trade Center. Thousands gathered at the site for a remembrance this morning. About 200 children read the names of loved ones who died when the towers fell.
Joseph Pumitalo.
Anna Gloria Pocasangre de Barrera.
John Potcher.
William Howard Pullman.
Lawrence Polach.
The ceremony paused four times, twice for the moments when the jetliner slammed into the trade towers and two more times for when the towers collapsed. President Bush led a moment of silence on the lawn of the White House to mark the moment when the first jet struck the World Trade Center, and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld laid a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery in memory of the 184 people killed at the Pentagon 2 years ago. He said those who died that day were part of the arsenal defending freedom and democracy.
Freedom is the birthright of every American. We know that to be so. But it is the birthright as well of every person, a gift of God, given to all but denied to many by tyrants, by dictators, who place their own power above human dignity and even human life.
A stained glass window honoring the victims was dedicated this morning at the Pentagon Chapel. In the Middle East, Palestinian leaders have decided to consolidate all of the Palestinian security services under a National Security Council headed by Yasser Arafat. But that's unlikely to satisfy Israeli or U.S. demands concerning control of Palestinian security, as NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Palestinian leaders made the decision to consolidate the security services as their new designated prime minister, Ahmed Correa, is trying to form a government. Correa succeeded Mahmoud Abbas, who resigned over the weekend after failing to wrest control of security from Arafat. The U.S. has taken a wait-and-see attitude toward Correa. U.S. officials say that he, like Abbas, must get control of security and use it to crack down on terrorist groups. A Bush administration official who asked not to be identified dismissed the latest move by the Palestinians as insufficient. The official says that consolidation of Palestinian security services under anyone other than an accountable prime minister free of association with terror and violence is not enough. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Relatives of the victims of a 1989 French airliner bombing say Libya has agreed to pay them more compensation. France had demanded an amount more in line with the compensation paid to families of those who died in the Lockerbie, Scotland bombing. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 44 points, the Nasdaq's up 9. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the U.S. trade deficit widened in July to $40.3 billion. Americans bought the second highest level of imported goods on record. The amount of Chinese imports and the amount of overseas crude imported into the U.S. each hit record highs. But exports also rose by more than $1.7 billion, thanks to overseas demand for capital goods, industrial supplies, autos, and auto parts from the United States. Microsoft says its Windows operating system has three more security holes that hijackers could use to control a user's computer. The flaws are related to the ones exploited by the Blaster virus this summer. Jason Lopez has more.
Microsoft says that hackers have yet to unleash a virus to exploit the flaws, but security firms are bracing for new versions of Blaster, That virus, called MS Blast and Lovesan, shut down scores of machines when it was released on the heels of Microsoft's announcement of security holes back in July. The virus also attempted but failed to attack a Microsoft website used for downloading software. This time around, the world's biggest software maker says its Windows programs are vulnerable to a hacker taking control of a user's machine and loading or deleting programs. Microsoft says the security flaws affect all its recent versions of Windows, except for the Millennium Edition Windows 98 and 98 SE. The company says a software patch is available on its website. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 45 points, the Nasdaq's up 10, the S&P is up 6. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
On the second anniversary of the September 11th attacks, the voices of children rose up over Ground Zero this morning.
Ina B. Pacina,
my father, Keith Legrand, worked on the 88th floor of the World Trade Center. I wanted to read you this poem because it says what I was feeling. Stars.
Walter David Bauer,
Jr. Gordon M. Amith. Junior.
Mark Lawrence Bavis.
And my uncle Stephen Palacino, we miss you so much.
Victims of the suicide hijackings were also remembered in somber ceremonies at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., where one flight crashed, and at a church service in rural Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where another plummeted into an empty field. Well, joining us from the studios of WNYC in New York is WNYC reporter Amy Eddings. And Amy, it seems as if the ceremonies at Ground Zero were quite powerful.
They were. It was stunning to hear those young voices. Some of the children were so small, their heads barely poked up above the podium. Many of them broke down while they were reading the names, especially tearing up and choking up when they read the names of their own family members who had perished. Quite an emotional ceremony.
Yeah. What else happened during the ceremony? I noticed in pictures that children, again, were putting together sort of their own monuments, building monuments with flowers and things.
Yes, the families were once again allowed to descend the seven-story ramp leading down into the pit, seven stories down below street level. And this time, though, it's much more of a construction site than it was 1 year ago today. Back then, the 16-acre site was much sparser. This time, it's a construction site. There's a commuter rail train that's being built, and the families were allowed into a much smaller area. There were two pools of water shaped like the footprints of the Twin Towers, and families were encouraged to place flowers in the water there. And as you mentioned, some had their own little rituals going on around the gravel at the bottom of the pit.
Well, it just pulverizes you know, to hear from them. But there was discussion before about whether or not children should even be involved, and many families said, you know, they had to leave the city on this, you know, too painful a day. So what was attendance like?
Attendance was much lighter than what I remember from this time last year. I got to the site both times, today and last year on September 11th, the first anniversary, at around 5:30 in the morning. And last year, there were people who had spent the night, who were there in their sleeping bags all along Church Street, which is the eastern edge of the World Trade Center site. There were many more people into the wee hours of the morning. It was much different this time, and far fewer families attended.
Well, we're hearing from mental health workers in New York that many families are just now feeling the impact of 9/11 2 years later. But what about the rest of New York? Were people offered the day off? Briefly, how did other New Yorkers approach this day?
For the most part, businesses said that it was business as usual, whereas there were some businesses, especially those in Lower Manhattan, the ones that were greatly affected by the World Trade Center collapse, businesses within the buildings themselves that allowed employees to take the day off, or they themselves marked that moment by not having work that day. But it was much different this time. You didn't get the feeling that a lot of businesses were allowing people to take a sick day or a personal day today.
Mm-hmm. Well, Amy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Reporter Amy Edding speaking to us from WNYC Radio in New York.
In the aftermath of 9/11, victims' families, however ravaged by grief, had to confront practicalities right away, like financial concerns. But 2 years now since the attacks, fully 60% of the families have not yet indicated whether they will accept federal compensation for their loss or pursue individual lawsuits. WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerov spoke with some families in Massachusetts who are still struggling with the decision, and she joins me now in the studio. Hi, Monica.
Hello.
Monica, the deadline for applying to the federal fund is approaching fast. It's December 22nd. Why is the number of people applying so low?
The people I spoke with said 2 years isn't long enough to make this decision. It's too soon to the event to sign your rights away to sue and really bring to a closure this whole time.
So yeah, for if you accept federal compensation, you can't sue.
And it's just too emotional of a time for them. Then there are also some illegal immigrants who fear applying to the fund would hurt their status. The federal government has tried to say that's not the case at all. You'll be fine. You know, this fund was set up to help victims of 9/11 as part of the airline bailout package. And the average award in the fund is $1.6 million. It sounds like a lot, but at the same time, that's an average. And what they do is take a look at how much money you've saved maybe in a life insurance or other plans and how much you would have earned over life. But what everybody told me is it's calculating what your loved one was worth to you monetarily. And that's extremely difficult to do, especially at this time of the year.
Some probably feel pursuing it in court, too, may yield more answers about what happened.
That's right. And those people are choosing to sue, and they're not going to the Victims' Compensation Fund. They want answers. And they say, really, it's not important whether or not they get a higher award in damages from a lawsuit. They just want to know what happened. One woman I spoke to, Julie Sweeney on Cape Cod, her husband Brian died in the World Trade Center. And she just has a list of questions she wants to be heard in open court.
How did people get through the security with box cutters and things of that nature, maybe some possibly other weapons that they haven't really come out and said yet? How did people that were profiled get on the planes? How did alerts from FBI, CIA, government agencies fall on deaf ears?
Monica, what about those who did file for federal compensation? Why did they make that decision?
One of the people I spoke to, David Gordonstein, who lost his wife on one of the airplanes, said for him, it's about time. He doesn't want the terrorists to take any more time from his life. He feels like they've already had enough.
I don't want them to rob any more time from my life. I mean, this past 2 years has been, you know, tumultuous at best. And, you know, I want to take my kids and move on. There isn't anything I can do to bring my wife back.
And David added that the last thing he wants to do is spend hundreds of hours in a courtroom somewhere when he's been given this other option, which he calls a gift. It's a gift from the U.S. government, in his view.
Yeah. Now, lawyers are advising relatives who haven't made their minds up yet. What are they telling them, do you think?
Well, the 2-year statute of limitations in New York to file a lawsuit was yesterday. That has been extended by 6 months. But there's a lot of confusion among lawyers as to whether that applies to relatives outside of New York, such as Massachusetts, which has a 3-year statute of limitations to file a lawsuit. So many of the families have been advised to file a lawsuit in suspension quickly so that they can have a little more time to decide, do I go with the Victims' Compensation Fund and choose not to sue, or do I pursue the lawsuit? Because filing a lawsuit in suspension doesn't commit them to that route, but it keeps that avenue open.
Monica Brady-Meyerov, thanks very much for joining us on Here and Now today.
You're welcome.
WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerov speaking about the Victims' Compensation Fund.
That's how he was. He was just loyal, said Tom Shannon, the kindergarten pal from 42 years ago.
Monday morning, a group of volunteers met at Ground Zero and began reading the short profiles of the victims of 9/11, originally published in the New York Times, called Portraits of Grief. They began with Gordy Amuth and will end sometime tonight with Igor Zuckelman. The 50 or so volunteers read in shifts of 2 to 4 hours. They stand in a row and pass the nearly 600-page book back and forth, giving passersby a snapshot of each lost life. Producer Karen Pellin visited Ground Zero on Tuesday and spoke with one of the organizers, Carl Palmer.
Tell me about your own personal experience on the morning of 9/11. Where were you and what was going on?
I'm originally from outside of New Orleans, and I was down in Louisiana doing a show, doing a play down there. And I was asleep when my sister called and turned on the TV, she said. And the thing about it was that, you know, I lived up here, but also my girlfriend at the time was working right across the street at the Deutsche Bank building. So, of course, you know, it took me a couple hours, but I was fortunate enough to get through to her. She was okay. She heard and saw both of them, but got out in time before the buildings came down.
When did you decide to do this, and how were you inspired to do this?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess in general, it's just, you know, a desire to be a tribute, obviously, to all these people. I felt bad when it happened because I wanted to be back up here to help out. And when I was reading the articles in the paper, it just really struck me, you know, I mean, more deeply than anything else, I think, than the videos and everything, just because they're so personal and you really get that sense of lives cut off.
Thomas McHale. Thomas McHale's notions for paying his college tuition ranged from taking chances at the gambling tables in Atlantic City to working behind the counter at his parents' deli on Long Island.
What's your name?
Yolanda Wilkinson. We hear about people who can cook, people who like going to the track, people who love their children, people who, one of the people I read, proposed to his wife in the shadow of the World Trade Center, and they both worked at the World Trade Center, and it's just sad and encouraging at the same time that it lets you know how valuable life is.
They were married in 1996, and their son, Colin Thomas, was born on October 18th, 5 weeks after Mr. McHale was killed in his office at Cantor Fitzgerald, where he was a mortgage security broker.
My name is Matt McGrath. Having lost a friend in the World Trade Center myself, one of my dearest friends and friends of my family's, Chris Hanley, was lost. He didn't work at Cantor Fitzgerald, but his girlfriend thought 2 days after the attack to ask somebody in his office to check his date book in his office, and there it said 9:30 Cantor Fitzgerald, very simply and tragically. So it is, you know, something that I can step outside and do on a day like today and be a part of this.
Is your friend's profile in that book? Did you read it?
I missed the H's, but I'll go back and check.
Michael G. McGinty. Growing up in an Air Force family, Michael G. McGinty moved many times. So when he and his wife Cynthia bought their first house in Foxborough, Mass., he put down roots, planting flowers to attract birds and butterflies, and becoming a chairman of the deacons of the Bethany Congregational Church.
The other day, a father who had lost a son, he asked if he could read his sons. So he just read his sons, you know, and I think that's what's, you know, so we just kind of keep it open. If people ask to read or if they ask us to read one of somebody they knew, we do that, you know. So.
Do you mind if I read one?
No, please do.
Okay. Donald J. McIntyre, Mr. Fix-It to the End. A multitasker before the term became trendy, Donald J. McIntyre never seemed to run short on energy or good intentions. A Port Authority police officer for 15 years, he was also a union trustee, a vigilant, wave-making trustee, said his wife, Janine. But around the house in New City, he was the sort of husband even the neighbors couldn't seem to get enough of. He shoveled driveways, ran errands, played Mr. Fix-It.
People Producer Karen Pellin reading one of the profiles of grief at Ground Zero. For current photos of Ground Zero and more information, please go to our website, here-now.org.
...and was on the scene of the September 11th disaster. As usual, he was multitasking. When he ran into the towers with his unit, he called his wife and promised to try and get to the 84th floor to search for his brother-in-law, John A. Sherry, a missing Eurobrokers trader, and he told her to skip work that night because he would not be home in time to babysit.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
2 years ago, Americans who weren't already became aware of tiny Gander, Newfoundland. Many Americans actually found themselves stranded there when 38 planes were forced to land at Gander International Airport in a frantic attempt to clear the skies of more possible terrorists. The entire town of 10,000 rolled up its sleeves and rolled out the red carpet for over 6,500 stranded travelers. Today, Gander will remember 9/11 with a memorial service for the victims and with the memories of the travelers who called the town home for several days. We have several guests joining us. First on the line from Gander is Mayor Claude Elliott. Welcome, Mayor.
Good afternoon.
Also on the line is Roxanne Loper. She was one of Gander's many guests. And Roxanne, are you down in Texas?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you for joining us. And Jim Defeedy is author of the book, The Day the World Came to Town, 9/11 in Gander, Newfoundland. It's just been re-released in paperback. It's a terrific read. Jim, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Roxanne, let's start with you first. There were so many stories of these passengers that were on these planes, but you and your husband were flying from Moscow to your home in Texas with a wonderful new surprise, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us about it.
We had been to Kazakhstan, actually. We'd been there for 3 weeks adopting a two-year-old.
Alexandria?
Yes.
And suddenly, as if that kind of a trip isn't nerve-shattering enough, you find yourself landing in Gander. Had you ever heard of Gander before?
No, never.
Mr. Mayor, you were up there in Gander. When you first heard that you were going to have to provide some sort of home for all of these passengers, what were your thoughts?
Well, I guess our thoughts was we weren't sure if just how long they were staying. We said we better get prepared for the worst-case scenario, that they're here for 4 or 5 days, and that's when we went into action.
Yeah. Jim Defeedy, you've talked to a lot of these people. Give us your overall sense of this combination of cultures.
The people of Newfoundland have a long history of being the types of folks who come running whenever there's trouble, whenever a neighbor's in trouble. That spirit has been fostered over generations. And so, I mean, in a way, it was the best possible place they could have landed.
The bus drivers, we hear, were on strike, and they came off strike to give us the rides to our different places to sleep.
Yeah, people stayed in people's homes. You stayed in the Lions Club.
Yes, and when we got there, there were already blow-up mattresses and sleeping bags and pillows and toothpaste and everything we could need.
There's points in your book, Jim, and maybe the mayor can chime in on this. There's a point where I guess somebody with a New York accent was on the street screaming, "Did you see that?" And everybody came running, and what he saw was a truck that stopped for people crossing the street without a stoplight. He was so stunned.
We have one gentleman, when they were ready to go back aboard the planes, we couldn't find him. And after about a 20 minutes or 25 minutes, we found him. He was in moose hunting with some of the hunters here.
And, Jim, there was a couple whose son was a missing firefighter in New York.
Yeah, that's the story of Hannah and Dennis O'Rourke. They were coming home after a vacation in Ireland, and when they landed and found out what was happening in New York City, their first thoughts went to their son, Kevin, a New York City firefighter, as you said. And pretty soon after they got off the plane, they learned that he was among the missing, and it wasn't until they got home that they found out that in fact, he had died. But it was the way the town responded when they learned that the parents of a firefighter was there in their midst that has always touched them and stayed with them to this day.
Yeah. Seeing it on TV, I would get incredibly angry and upset, and as everyone would. And when they would see one particular person was Bruce McLeod, the president of the Lions Club,
when he would see me get shook up, he would pull me to the side. In fact, he even threw me on his motorcycle once and took me for a ride. So they were there. They were there for us to hold our hands and give us hugs and balance things for us.
Well, Mr. Mayor, isn't it true, too? I always got this impression that while you and the folks in town were helping the passengers deal with this terrible tragedy that was taking place, the fact that you were able to do that actually helped you and the rest of the townspeople also sort through what was going on in this tragedy. You know, it gave you something positive to do.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The whole community became involved in actually the tragedy that took place so far away brought everybody so close together, even in our community.
I hear, complete strangers were walking up and dragging people like Roxanne into their houses to take showers and giving the plane people, taking them out bar hopping if they needed it. And did anyone actually do a screeching in, Mr. Mayor? I guess that's a ritual in Gander. It involves a little bit of alcohol, and it has to do with becoming an honorary Newfoundlander.
Yes, it do. You get a certificate and everything to go with it.
Yeah.
And of course, you get to kiss a cod, which is something that most people don't get to do in their normal lives.
That's right.
Mr. Mayor, what is Gander doing today?
Today we're having an incommunicable service at 7 p.m., which is sponsored by the Ministerial Association, and all churches coming together to remember the tragic event of September 11th of 2 years ago.
Do you miss your guests?
After they left, it was like we had lost a family. But we still, today, there's still people coming back, and they've developed relationships that will last for a lifetime.
Well, and it's not just people coming back to Gander. I've been amazed at the number of people from Gander who have now gone visiting the folks in the United States that stayed with them. Folks in the United States have turned around and sort of said, come on down and stay with us.
It is. It's working both ways.
Roxanne, one last question. Mm-hmm. What will you tell Alexandria about her beginning?
Oh, wow. We had quite the experience and quite the story to tell her when she gets bigger. And thanks to Jim, we now have a book that we can give her.
That's the amazing thing, too, about Alexandria. How is Alexandria, by the way?
She's doing wonderful. She's just turned four.
Good.
Because here, Roxanne, you think to yourself, you're bringing this child home from Kazakhstan, an area that probably would be a dangerous place for a child to grow up. And yet you were thinking, okay, now we're bringing her home to the safety of the United States. And suddenly you realize that day you're bringing her home almost into a possible war zone.
Yeah, there for a few days I was certainly questioning what we had just done.
But you don't anymore, I know.
No, not at all.
And besides, she now, Mr. Mayor, it sounds like she has a whole town that cares about her future.
Absolutely, and for every day we still, there's still a lot of turmoil in this world today, but we certainly will pray for our American friends and the people throughout the world that someday we'll all live in peace.
Well, I want to thank all of you.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate
it.
Thank you.
Roxanne Loper was on an international flight 2 years ago. Her story is one of several in Jim Defeatty's book, The Day the World Came to Town, 9/11 in Gander, Newfoundland. And Gander's mayor is Claude Elliott.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll look at the effects of Washington's war on terrorism on the people of Afghanistan and Iraq.
And we'll check out the state of Homeland Security 2 years on.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Bush calls for wider powers in hunting down terrorists.
And is the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui going to be thrown out of court?
If the government, as expected, refuses to produce these two additional witnesses, the judge is going to sanction the government, and the possible punishments may very well be even dismissing the case.
And a young cello virtuoso does his part to remember September 11th, starting today, taking Bach to funky local clubs.
I think it was years and years of looking out into the audience and seeing only gray hairs. You know, I'm not seeing anyone of my own generation in the audience.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. 200 children and young adults, each of whom lost a relative in the most devastating terror attack ever in the U.S., paid tribute to their loved ones today at Ground Zero. Approaching microphones in pairs, they read the names of 2,792 loved ones who died there exactly 2 years ago.
I love you, Daddy. I miss you a lot. Richard Anthony Achetta.
My loving father, Patrick Adams. We love you and miss you.
And my uncle, Stephen Palacino. We miss you so much.
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the victims should never be forgotten, even as the city moves forward.
Today again, we are a city that mourns. We come here to honor those that we lost and to remember this day with sorrow. But we also remember with pride. And from that comes our resolve to go forward.
Ceremonies continue around the nation today to mark the second anniversary of 9/11. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says there is no rush to try suspected terrorists arrested in the aftermath of 9/11 and being held at a U.S. prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Rumsfeld says most of the 660 suspects from 42 countries will probably be detained for the course of the global war on terrorism rather than face trial. That has sparked criticism from lawyers and human rights activists around the world who say there's no authority in U.S. or international law to hold people indefinitely with no judicial process. A British parliamentary panel that's been investigating the government's pre-war claims about Iraq released its report today, saying that Prime Minister Tony Blair's government did not deliberately exaggerate a report on Iraqi weapons by including a disputed claim about chemical and biological weapons. But the lawmakers did criticize the way the government presented the claim that Iraq was ready to launch some weapons at 45 minutes' notice. The U.S. trade deficit widened to $40.3 billion in July as the imports from China and the quantity of overseas crude oil sold to the U.S. each hit record highs. While the latest snapshot of the nation's trade activity showed the trade gap grew by 0.7%, it was slightly smaller than what economists were predicting. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush is calling on Congress to expand the USA Patriot Act, passed 2 years ago in the wake of 9/11.
We've taken unprecedented effective measures to protect this homeland. Yet our nation has more to do. We will never be complacent. We will defend our people, and we will win this war.
President Bush speaking at the FBI Training Academy in Quantico, Virginia yesterday. Joining me on the line now to talk about what the White House is requesting is New York Times White House correspondent David Sanger. Welcome.
Thank you.
David, three major components of what the president asked for yesterday at Quantico, would you say?
There were three amendments to the Patriot Law that he was talking about. One of them would deny bail under most circumstances to terrorism suspects. One would allow for administrative subpoenas, allowing investigators to issue subpoenas for documents and so forth without going in front of a judge or a grand jury. This had been suggested by the administration in the initial Patriot Act, and it was dropped out of the bill. And then there was a third element to all of this, which was to make the death penalty apply in cases of sabotage of federal facilities, of nuclear power plants, if the act of sabotage resulted in a death.
These administrative subpoenas, you don't go before a judge. Who does decide then whether someone is subpoenaed?
Well, the president made the point that these are used at various times in healthcare fraud investigations and so forth. Now, in most cases, they could be appealed to the judge if the person who is receiving the subpoena wants to. But this would change the basic use of these. In most cases, not in all, but in most, say the government wants to get telephone records. The company that would turn over the records wants to have something in writing, mostly to protect themselves against their own liability, to indicate that they were forced to turn these over. It's not necessarily something they would want to protest. In a terrorism case, presumably the relationship between the government investigator and the group being investigated could be very different.
David, as someone who follows what goes on in Washington and the mood there very closely, how do you think this is going to go down in Congress, which, of course, will have to approve all this?
Well, to some degree, the president gets an advantage out of this either way. If he gets them, then they get additional strengthening of the Patriot Act over the objections, of course, of the 160 communities or so that have objected to the current Patriot Act. If he doesn't get it, then he has something to campaign on. He has something to point out a difference with whatever Democratic candidate emerges. And if there is another terrorist attack between now and the election, which many believe is very possible, then he can step forward and say, see, I had argued for stronger protections here at home.
Well, David Sanger, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
New York Times White House correspondent David Sanger.
There is another confrontation looming between the government and the judge in the case of the alleged September 11th co-conspirator, the so-called 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. One week ago, Judge Leonie Brinkema ruled that Moussaoui must be given access to two al-Qaeda captives who could potentially help his case. The government refused, but did offer to provide written summaries of what the al-Qaeda captives might say if they could testify. Well, Brinkema said that would not suffice. A showdown approaches, and the Justice Department yesterday acknowledged it's risking the dismissal of the charges. Jerry Markin is the Washington Post staff writer covering the Moussaoui trial. He joins us from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Judge Leonie Brinkema says the government must let Moussaoui interview the two al-Qaeda captives, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Mustafa Houssaoui, and a third. This is Ramzi bin al-Shib. The judge ordered the government to produce him as a witness last January. First, remind us, what happened there?
Well, what happened there is basically what we're expecting is likely to happen again today. The government refused because the Justice Department thinks that taking a key al-Qaeda captive out of an important interrogation could mess up the interrogation, and they basically think it's a security threat, so they refused.
But is there any precedent for their offer of sort of providing the answers they think that the captives might provide if they were allowed to be interrogated?
Right. That's a process known as substitutions. Yes, there is. That's actually a process which is mandated in the federal law, which governs what happens when a party in a case wants to use classified information. Obviously, what these al-Qaeda detainees are saying to their government interrogators is classified. And so the substitutions are sort of a middle ground for the government to try when there's a dispute like this. In fact, I should add that Judge Brinkema's decisions to order that the defense have access to these three witnesses itself was based purely on information provided by the government. It's based on existing classified government summaries of what these detainees have been saying. And obviously, we know from what Brinkema has said publicly that what the government has revealed already shows that these folks have what she considers to be information that's exculpatory to Massawi that could help the case, although the government disputes that.
Mm. And what can happen now? What if the government refuses to comply with the judge's order?
If the government, as expected, refuses to produce these two additional witnesses, the judge is going to sanction the government, and the possible punishments may very well be even dismissing the case or possibly striking the possibility of a death sentence against Massawi, at which point the government is expected to appeal again.
Is there also a possibility that if this doesn't go well for the government, they might move the case to a military tribunal?
Yep, that is an active possibility. If they are ordered ultimately to produce the witness, what they've indicated up to now is that that's probably what they will do, dismiss the case entirely or move to dismiss the case, judge would have to approve it, and put Massawi before a military tribunal. But, you know, the Justice Department has indicated pretty strongly that they don't want to have to do that. They don't want to have to get to that point.
And finally, you mentioned that the judge says that she feels that in what she knows of what the al-Qaeda operatives have said to the government, that in fact this is something that could help Massawi in his case. Do we have any idea of what that is?
To a limited extent, I have some idea. Of the two witnesses at issue now, the key one is probably Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the former operations chief for al-Qaeda. He's in custody. He was captured in Pakistan last spring. My information, and I've reported this in the Post, is that he has been telling his government interrogators that, well, Massawi was affiliated with al-Qaeda, as Massawi himself has admitted in open court, and was sent to the United States for an al-Qaeda mission to kill Americans, that this mission was supposed to occur after September 11th. In other words, that Massawi was not slated to be a direct participant in the September 11th attacks. And that could be an issue because Massawi is charged with participating in a broad conspiracy that led to the September 11th attacks.
Well, Jerry, thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry Markin, staff writer with The Washington Post, speaking to us from Alexandria, Virginia.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please do tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from.
You're listening to Here and Now.
How present is al-Qaeda in the United States? Well, very is the answer of many intelligence officials, and they are very possibly as dangerous and maybe more dangerous than ever, despite the largest FBI investigation ever, involving 7,000 agents who've conducted more than 180,000 interviews. Josh Meyer is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times who has a story on al-Qaeda in the United States in today's paper. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Josh.
Hi.
Josh, you write, al-Qaeda maintains a largely invisible but extensive presence in the United States that includes logistical support, recruiting, and fundraising. Now, who's telling you this?
Well, we really can't divulge sources, but it is U.S. Sure. counterterrorism officials, and it's also officials overseas. But they're saying that, yes, it's the people that they believe are in the United States are keeping in contact in some way with people in the larger network as well.
Josh, what's happening right now to indicate that al-Qaeda is here? Are certain individuals being pursued, that sort of thing?
One authority told me that at least several dozen people that are believed to be involved in al-Qaeda plots are being pursued. The FBI's chief of counterterrorism, Larry Mefford, said in a briefing last week with reporters that there's investigations ongoing in as many as 40 states. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security now have, I think, 86 joint terrorism task forces around the country, and all of them are actively investigating what they believe are good leads on terrorism cases.
Josh, have you ever raised with any of your sources why, if there are al-Qaeda in the United States, one or more of them don't, God forbid, just get a grenade or a machine gun and go into a mall and make that kind of a statement? Why has there been no al-Qaeda violence in 2 years?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, top officials of the FBI say that they're amazed that there haven't been any suicide bombings in the United States, and they're very, very fearful that that's going to happen anytime soon. In Europe, they've rolled up literally hundreds of people that were sort of on the verge of launching attacks, and there hasn't been such a case here, and people are very puzzled about that.
As we noted in our introduction, and as you just said, there have been successes in the war against al-Qaeda. Is it their bench strength, if you will, that enables them to sustain operations?
Right. I mean, what several experts and U.S. officials have told me is that al-Qaeda is almost like a corporation in that it has a success in strategy in which people are groomed to take over for others if they're arrested or captured or killed, and that they do have deep bench strength. In fact, even the CIA said that in a report earlier this week, and that, you know, when one person is arrested or killed, somebody else almost immediately steps up and takes their place.
Yeah. What's been the effect on recruiting for al-Qaeda, do you think, of the occupation of Iraq?
Well, I'm told from law enforcement and intelligence sources that that's the best thing that could have ever happened to al-Qaeda in the sense that it's turned, you know, militant Muslims and even, you know, people sort of sitting on the fence, as it were, against the United States. And it's helped al-Qaeda around the world sort of piggyback onto local and national political and religious movements and use them to, you know, to recruit people for the larger cause.
Josh, just to finish up, do the men and women you talk to with knowledge about these things, expect another attack in the United States?
Yes, unfortunately. They also say, though, that they don't believe that there's going to be an attack of the magnitude of September 11th because it would take too much planning and that they have the mechanisms in place now to stop something like that. But they're very fearful of suicide bombs. They're very fearful of dirty bombs, radioactive, low-level radioactive bombs, and also biological and chemical attacks.
Josh Meyer, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Josh Meyer is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from Washington, D.C.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
CBGB's in New York City is one of those well-worn music clubs where punk rock, rockabilly, sometimes college radio bands, find their audience. So what was cello virtuoso Matt Haimovitz doing there last year playing Bach? A teen prodigy, Matt Haimovitz made his debut in 1984 with the Israel Philharmonic, under the baton of Zubin Mehta. Since then, he's performed under James Levine and Seiji Ozawa and with the world's greatest orchestras. But today, in response to the terror of September 11th, Haimovitz begins a series of concerts, a continuation of last year's listening room tour of small clubs. He'll play Bach, new American compositions, and an American classic. This interpretation of Jimi Hendrix was recorded at CBGB's last year. Producer Andrea Shea caught up with cellist Matt Haimovitz at his home in Northampton, Massachusetts, as he was getting ready for today's tour.
CBGB was the most extreme club that I've played, for sure. It's funny that that place originated as a place for blues and country music and bluegrass, but ended up being very famous for the punk movement. So a lot of these venues, what's so wonderful about them is that they start off with a certain vision of what they want to present, but then they're open to all sorts of other genres, and that's I felt very welcome across the country. You know, places like in Seattle, the Tractor Tavern, you know, Sam Bond's Garage in Eugene, Oregon.
Which is, of course, not necessarily what can be said for your previous venues over your life where you've played and performed in really some of the most famous halls around the world.
Well, you know, I just came back from Brazil, and I played in Porto Alegre in just a gorgeous old-style sort of Italian opera theater, 1,000 seats with 3 tiers, with velvet cushioned seats and that type of atmosphere. And it's remarkable. And there's, you know, you play in the Musikverein in Vienna, or you play in the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. To this day, I always look forward to walking down those many, many steps to get to the stage of the Concertgebouw. And throughout this country, you have Boston Symphony Hall, one of the great halls, Benaroya Hall in Seattle. These are wonderful sanctuaries for music. However, because of the formality of some of these spaces and because of the regularity that they present concerts, what should be events, often in presenting the same repertoire over and over again in the same way, become somewhat routine. So I've, for me, now when I come back to the Concertgebouw or one of these concert halls, it's a very fresh experience again because I've been having these adventures, you know, around the world in these alternative venues. And so I can take pleasure and just delight in what the concert hall really has to offer.
Well, I'd love to talk more specifically about the listening room, just the origins of this idea, but I'd love to see your instrument.
Sure. I can take you back to to where it's housed in my studio. Getting to my studio, we have to walk through the dining room, and right now, getting ready for this anthem tour that I'm about to embark on, a 50-state tour. Virtually every corner of the house is being taken up by something related to the tour. Here in the dining room, we've got the T-shirts, which just came in, kind of rock style with the venues on the back. The air conditioning in this room is always on for my instrument, which has to be in a temperature-controlled space. So here's my instrument. It's a Matteo Goffriller cello, a Venetian instrument from 1710, one of the great cellos.
And now this is an instrument from the 1700s, and Bach was doing something similar to what you're doing in the 1700s.
Yeah, I mean, the origin of this instrument, I'm sure it saw a few coffee houses in its day. Things like the Brandenburg Concerti were allegedly premiered in a coffee house in Leipzig, and he certainly enjoyed his brew and frequented those places.
So, you know, you're used to performing with James Levine or Zubin Mehta, Seiji Ozawa. Now you're doing Jimi Hendrix on stage. Talk a little bit about what inspired you in the first place to start this listening room tour.
I think it was years and years of looking out into the audience and seeing only gray hairs. You know, I'm not seeing anyone of my own generation in the audience, and taking inspiration from the more popular genres, really, in terms of, you know, you see a young band starting out, they've got to, from scratch in a way, build their audience and bring music, you know, music that they've written and turn it into a hit for this new audience. We, in the classical music world, we have these hits that have survived hundreds of years, but slowly people are forgetting about them. And those hits were, in their own time, groundbreaking cultural achievements. I mean, when Bach wrote his 6 suites for cello, it was nothing like it before. It was really something completely new and kind of bizarre and strange. And what I'm trying to do, for example, with my anthem tour, bringing American living composers, and it's anchored with the Hendrix Star Spangled Banner, I'm trying to bring this to parts of the country where you wouldn't necessarily come into contact with this music, and kind of illustrate that classical music is a breathing, living genre, that there are composers doing very innovative, emotionally powerful stuff with even something as simple as the solo cello.
And my idea for this tour, in part, is hopefully to show that there's a lot to be proud of in this country that is not politically motivated, that is actually more of a cultural pride, let's say. So for me, the Hendrix, what he did during the Vietnam era, really resonates for me.
So this tour is really in response to things going on in the world, your way as an artist to respond.
It is. I have to say that it evolved, though. I mean, initially, even before 9/11, I was thinking about an American album. When 9/11 happened, I kind of felt like I wanted to do something patriotic. And I have to say, over the 2-3 years since, that feeling has kind of really evolved and in some ways matured into a very complex relationship with my own country and also the country of my birth, Israel. And sort of seeing music originally, you know, after 9/11, I kind of couldn't play the instrument for a few days, and I sort of felt like nothing made sense. What was the role of music in this time? That kind of evolving into a sense of, well, this is my own voice, and this is what I can do, and this is far more beautiful than, you know, just destruction. And so I think this tour, in part, definitely reflects my view that it would be very nice if music could replace bombs.
It's amazing to watch you play the Star Spangled Banner a la Jimi Hendrix. I mean, you're really going at the instrument. You're very,
right,
very old instrument,
right,
compared to playing something maybe a little more delicately. How does that feel for you?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I commissioned 2 new American cellos to be made for this tour. I love playing it on my instrument because I have, you know, I know my instrument so well, and it gives me every color, even some of the less beautiful colors, if you want to put it that way. So, yeah, I'm not going to, you know, go play CBGB and, like, crack my cello in half and throw it out into the audience. And I wouldn't do that with a modern cello either. But I thought it would be fun to play some of these American pieces on an American-made cello. I thought that would be kind of a nice idea.
Cellist Matt Haimovitz, with cellos very old and brand new, begins his Listening Room tour tonight at the Tractor Tavern in Seattle, Washington. For more information on his 50-state road trip and his new CD called Anthem, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
The day after September 11th, we'll look at the effects of Washington's war on terrorism on the people of Afghanistan and Iraq.
And the state of homeland security 2 years on.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.